Ezekiel chapter 10, page 114. In this continuation of the vision, the prophet is shown another aspect of the coming judgment. Chapters 8 and 9 were concerned primarily with the temple. The message there was that the spiritual apostasy would be judged by God. Here in chapter 10 and also in chapter 11, the city is the main feature singled out as the object of God's judgments. Apostasy, as it revealed itself in their civil and social life, was to receive like judgment. That the glory which had left the mercy seat and stood on the threshold of the temple to supervise the judgment of the apostate nation is indeed the same glory as that which he had earlier seen by the river Kibar, is now made plain. The judgments are now said to be under the supervision and control of the cherubim. And verse 20 of this chapter shows that the cherubim are the same living creatures as in chapter 1. We learn that the cherubim stood on the right side of the house, which would be, as is given in the RSV, the south side of the house. We suggest the following is the sequence of being presented in the vision. 1. The glory of Yahweh, that is the man, like burning bronze from his loins up and like fire from his loins down, has left the cherub in the Most Holy and is standing on the threshold of the temple. He it is who now speaks to the man clothed in linen and says, "Go in between the wheels, even under the cherub, and fill thine hand with coals of fire from between the cherubim and scatter them over the city." Verses 3 to 5 then should be read as a parenthesis, and they tell us that the cherubim are somewhere on the south of the temple, either in the middle court or in the inner court. The cloud, which from chapter 1 we know to be associated with the cherubim, filled the inner court, and the sound of the cherubim's wings was heard in the outer court. The account of the vision is continued in verse 6, where we learn that the man, having received his instructions, approaches the cherubic chariot and stands beside the wheels, where one of the living creatures gives to him fire from between the cherubim. The man takes it and goes out to scatter the coals of fire over the city. It may be recalled that when we considered chapter 1, we related the fire, which was a notable feature of the cherubic chariot, to the judgment of God to be meted out by Nebuchadnezzar. Speaking of the judgment of Israel because of their rejection of Yahweh, God predicted through Moses, "A fire is kindled in mine anger and shall burn unto the lowest hell and shall consume the earth with her increase and set on fire the foundations of the mountains." Jeremiah also prophesied concerning these judgments when he exhorted the people, "Circumcise yourselves to the Lord and take away the foreskins of your heart, ye men of Judah and inhabitants of Jerusalem, lest my fury come forth like fire and burn, that none can quench it because of the evil of your doings." And again in Jeremiah, with reference to Deuteronomy 32, God says, "I will make thee to pass with thine enemies into a land which thou knowest not, for a fire is kindled in mine anger which shall burn upon you." Thus, the fire represents the judgment of Yahweh upon his people. And the man in linen, in taking the fire and throwing it upon the city, is pouring out God's judgments. As in the previous chapters, there appears to be here also a close connection with certain aspects of temple service. We have suggested that the Babylonian armies in whom God was manifested constituted the altar upon which Israel was to be offered. The altar, as the lion of God, was coming to devour that which belonged to it. And here in chapter 10, we are introduced to the altar fire. Our God, says Paul, is a consuming fire. The connection between God and the fire on the altar is very plain. The fire in both the tabernacle and Solomon's temple was fire from heaven. At the time of the consecration of the Aaronic priesthood, we read, there came a fire out from before the Lord and consumed upon the altar the burnt offering and the fat, which when all the people saw, they shouted and fell on their faces. A similar manifestation occurred at the consecration of Solomon's temple. This fire on the altar was never allowed to go out. It was kept burning continually according to the instruction, the fire shall ever be burning upon the altar. It shall never go out. And Leviticus 16 details the ritual that had to be carried out on the National Day of Atonement. Having killed the bullock to make atonement for himself and his house, the high priest was required to take a censer of fire before Yahweh. And he shall take a censer full of burning coals of fire from off the altar before the Lord, and his hands full of sweet incense, beaten small, and bring it within the veil, and he shall put the incense upon the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of the incense may cover the mercy seat that is upon the testimony, that he die not. In the introduction to the trumpet visions in Revelation, we have this same ritual referred to in a way that it enables us to connect it with Ezekiel's vision. Another angel came and stood at the altar having a golden censer, and there was given unto him much incense that he should offer it with the prayers of all saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense which came with the prayers of the saints, ascended up before God out of the angel's hand. And the angel took the censer and filled it with fire at the altar and cast it upon the earth. And there were voices and thunderings and lightnings and an earthquake. In this passage from Revelation 8, the ministering angel stands at the altar, presumably the brazen altar of sacrifice. He is given incense, which is intended to be offered on the golden altar, and then he takes fire from off the altar, and two things happen. One, the incense ascends up to God together with the prayers of the saints, and the angel casts the altar fire upon the earth, which results in the outpouring of judgment symbolized by the seven trumpets. This is obviously very similar to Ezekiel 10, where the priestly man takes the coals of fire from the consuming fire in the midst of the Babylonian altar and casts it into the city. In the divinely appointed ritual, both in the tabernacle and the temple, altar fire combined with the right ingredients offered upon the golden altar in the holy place or on the censer in the most holy produced odors well pleasing to God. It was extremely important, however, that the ingredients were very carefully noted and the incense carefully prepared. The priesthood was expressly commanded, you shall offer no strange incense thereon. In keeping with the principle that the law was a shadow of good things to come, we find that the incense offered in the sanctuary was symbolic of prayer. Connection between prayer and incense is very clear. David said, let my prayer be set before thee as incense. Let my prayer be set forth before thee as incense. When Zacharias was ministering in the temple, offering up the incense, we read, the whole multitude of the people were praying without at the time of incense. In Revelation 5, we are told of the 24 elders falling down before the Lamb, and of them it is written that they had golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. Revised Version. Thus, the incense offered in the tabernacle and in the temple was symbolic of prayer. Those who were in covenant relationship with God and who were serving in the holy place offered the incense. It was burned by fire taken from the altar of burnt offering and was therefore a burnt offering. Prayer ideally is this, the complete consumption and absorption of our hopes, desires and personal wishes to the will and purpose of Yahweh, so that our life ascends as a sweet smell to Him. Prayer is the sacrifice of the lips. For our purposes, the following points will be noted, although Brother H.P. Mansfield has given a detailed exposition of the connection between prayer and incense in his book, Making Prayer Powerful. And for our purposes, the following points will be noted. One, incense was made of special ingredients, carefully compounded together, indicating that the privilege of prayer should be undertaken with diligence and care. Two, the ingredients had to be of like weight, indicating that prayer has to be balanced, containing a mixture of thanksgiving and requests, of praise and petition. Incense was offered evening and morning, demonstrating the important principle that prayer should be offered at regular intervals. It was called a perpetual incense, showing that we should pray without ceasing. Incense was to be offered exclusively to Yahweh, indicating that He, and He alone, is to be the object of our devotions. Incense had to be salted. Salt was an element of every sacrifice that was offered in Israel and is spoken of as the salt of the covenant of thy God. Here is another teaching that prayer is indeed a sacrifice, and for it to be accepted, it must be combined with the salt of the covenants of promise. And strange incense was punished by death. Infringement of the injunctions in the preparation and offering of the incense was an abomination to God. In Leviticus 10, we have an example of what happened when men offered incense to God in an unfaithful way. Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took either of them his censer and put fire therein and put incense thereon and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he commanded them not. And there went out fire from the Lord and devoured them, and they died before the Lord. Now, we will apply these things to the vision in Ezekiel 10. The people of Israel in the time of the prophet were offering strange incense to God. It is written in the Proverbs, "He that turneth away his ear from hearing the law, even his prayer shall be an abomination." This was the situation in Israel. They had turned away their ear from hearing the law of God. Because of this, their prayers rose up to God as strange incense, and their prayers were not acceptable before him. So it was that Jeremiah was commanded, "Pray not thou for this people, neither lift up a cry or prayer for them, for I will not hear them in the time that they cry unto me for their trouble." The ingredients of Israel's prayers were not what God required. They were too self-centered. There was no balance in their prayers. They overlooked and took for granted the love and mercy and long-suffering of God. And their prayers were not offered exclusively to Yahweh. The salt of the covenant was lacking. They had turned away their ear from hearing the law. And because they were offering this strange incense, these unacceptable prayers, they were to be punished. Therefore, that which under normal circumstances combined with the incense and produced a savour well-pleasing to God was, as in the case of Nadab and Abihu, to go out from Yahweh and consume them. Returning now briefly to verses 3 to 5, we take up a brief consideration of the thread that runs through chapters 8 to 11. The story of the departure of Yahweh's glory. In verse 3, we learn that the cherubim, or living creatures of Kibar, are on the right side of the house. In verse 4, we are told that the glory of Yahweh, which normally resided in the most holy place, went up from the cherub and stood over the threshold. Now, this is a reminder of the situation already presented to us in chapter 9. The cherubim here in verse 4 and in chapter 9, verse 3, refers to the cherubim in the most holy place, not to the cherubic chariot on the right side of the temple. And this is the beginning of the departure of Yahweh's glory from the midst of his people. In verse 1, when the cherubic chariot appears, bearing aloft the throne, there's no mention of it being occupied. The throne appears to be empty. But now the glory of Yahweh, which has left the most holy place in the temple, leaves the threshold and takes up a position above the cherubic chariot. The glory of the Lord departed from off the threshold and stood over the cherubim. Presumably, he is going to occupy the throne, just as we saw the likeness of the glory of Yahweh occupying this throne in chapter 1. The cherubic chariot, now bearing aloft the glory of Yahweh, moves towards the east gate of the house with the glory of the God of Israel over them above. The final movement of the cherubic chariot, taking the glory from the midst of the people of Israel, is recorded in chapter 11, where we read, "Then did the cherubim lift up their wings, and the wheels beside them." And the glory of the God of Israel was over them above. And the glory of the Lord went up from the midst of the city and stood upon the mountain which is on the east side of the city. This mountain on the east would undoubtedly be the Mount of Olives. Thus, in preparation for the judgment soon to come upon his people, Yahweh was removing his divine presence from their midst. The next time Ezekiel sees the cherubim is in his vision of the restoration, where, having been shown the temple of the age to come, he is brought to the east gate. And there, this is in chapter 43, "The glory of the God of Israel came from the way of the east. It was according to the appearance of the vision which I saw, even according to the vision that I saw when I came to destroy the city. And the visions were like the vision that I saw by the river Kibar. And I fell upon my face. And the glory of the Lord came into the house by the way of the gate, whose prospect is toward the east. And he said unto me, Son of man, the place of my throne, and the place of the soles of my feet, where I will dwell in the midst of the children of Israel forever, and my holy name shall the house of Israel no more defile." It is remarkable that 600 years later, when the Lord Jesus, in whom Yahweh's glory was made manifest in the midst of Israel, when he addressed his farewell to the city of Jerusalem, he said, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them which are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate." The glory was departing from Israel. When Jesus left this earth, there were some who, like Ezekiel, saw the glory leave. The last they saw of him was on the Mount of Olives, where angels promised that he would come again. When he comes again, he comes from the east as the Sun of Righteousness, rising with healing in his beams, his feet standing upon the Mount of Olives. And this is that of which Ezekiel speaks in chapter 43. We're still looking for the restoration of which the prophets spoke, when the glory of Yahweh, manifest in Christ and his saints, will again dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. Well might the prophet Haggai say, the latter glory of this house shall be greater than the former.